thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Digital Campus number 8 for the 13th of June 2007. Basic Training. I'm Dan Cohen. And welcome back once again to another episode of Digital Campus. I would like to welcome all the new listeners. Just looking at the stats for our audience, and we've noticed that they've grown by leaps and bounds recently, so we'd like to welcome all of the new listeners and, of course, encourage people who are new to the program to, of course, go back and look at our archives. Notice in particular that our episode on Wikipedia is very popular, as was our last episode, which was really fun to do with Bill Turkle on history appliances. So a really unique discussion that we had last week around a roundtable with a very innovative young historian who's working really on the frontiers of digital history and the use of technology in learning and scholarship. And this week, of course, I'm joined by the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
Good to talk to you. And, of course, Mills Kelly from edwired.org. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
Well, good to talk to you both again. And, of course, I'm Dan Cohen, online at dancohen.org. And for new listeners, who might have missed the opening, we, of course, are all from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And as the program goes on, we've already done this with one of our staff members, but we're going to draw in from our large circle of very talented people here at the center to, you know, talk about some of the issues like we did with Jeremy Boggs on web design for universities and libraries and museums. And, of course, bring in some guests from outside of our circle, like Bill Turkle, as we get a chance to dial them up over Skype or see them in person, as we did last week with Bill. So, as we do every week, we like to begin the podcast with our news roundup. And one news item that has been kind of sitting in our queue to discuss for a while has been the EDUCAUSE review article on the top 10 IT issues for 2007 on campus. And we all found this to be a very interesting list, which we will begin picking apart in a second. But for those who didn't read the article, I will count down, I suppose, from 10 to 1. And these were the issues that I guess they were CIOs, is that right, Tom and Mills?
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
So chief information technology officers. What they thought were really important issues for the coming year. Number 10 was governance, organization, and leadership for IT. 9 was course learning management system. So I guess that would be things like Blackboard and Sakai. Number 8 was strategic planning. 7 was infrastructure. 6 was faculty development, support, and training. 5 was disaster recovery and business continuity. 4 was identity and access management. Number 3 was administrative, ERP, and information systems. Number 2 was security, which we've talked a lot about. In fact, last week we discussed campus IT security in depth. And number 1 was funding IT.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. So, Mills, Tom, what were your initial reactions to this list?
Yeah, I mean, my initial reaction was that this is kind of a self-regarding list. It seems like all but two or, maybe three of these things look like they're, number one explicitly is asking for more funding for IT, and presumably that money goes to the CIO's office. But of the remaining nine, you know, six or maybe seven of them are basically also asking for more funding for the CIO's office. I mean, number 10, I think, is the most telling, that governance, organization, and leadership for IT, that they're asking basically for, you know, I don't know, more staff, more help, more whatever for them, for themselves. And I was struck by, conversely, I was struck by the fact that only one of them actually mentions faculty explicitly, and none of them mention students explicitly, except you maybe could say that number nine, course learning management systems, has to do with teaching and students and faculty. So I just think that the balance here between you know, the emphasis on the administration versus the emphasis on the core teaching and learning mission of the university is a little off.
Yeah, I have to say, when I read this list, I engaged in some fairly significant eye rolling for much the same reason, largely because of the complete and total lack of focus on students and their education. I would say that course learning management systems, item 9, doesn't even really count. That's just an administrative kind of thing. Having a management system isn't the same thing as having quality educational opportunities for the students. And so, you know, we talk a lot about how students today have these incredible technology skills, but as I've said over and over for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, just because they're technologically able doesn't mean that they actually know how to learn with the technology. And so there's, you know, there's no vision in here in this list for anything related to teaching and learning other than just kind of general management of the process. And I think, you know, if you look at the list of who put this report together, that explains why teaching and learning are essentially absent from it. And that's because they're all chief information officers. They're not people engaged in the actual teaching and learning enterprise at the core of what universities do. Nor is there any real, I don't see research in here either. Anywhere.
No. Public service. There's nothing about, you know, reaching
access
out
to
the general public or anything. It's all kind of this. It's a very internalist list, just internal to the CIO's office.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, some of these are, there's clearly a certain level of fright going on right now. I think, you know, I think CIOs have a very difficult job, and you know, we did mention security last week, and indeed we're undergoing this huge security review at George Mason of all of our servers, because, you know, as I mentioned, I think Ohio University was getting a really bad rap for poor security. And my feeling was, you know, having dealt with our server and many other servers and projects before, you know, the good hacks and security breaches, you just don't know about. And so I think there's this, you know, you can get literally a false sense of security, I think. And so I can see where that would be a problem. And also, of course, in a kind of post 9/11 and Katrina world, number 5, disaster recovery is a big item. But it seemed like, you know, I agree with what both of you said. You know, I think a lot of these, you know, identity and access management, strategic planning, infrastructure, I think there's just this feeling that there's, you know, huge growth and problems that are really tough to tackle at this point, especially with, you know, just the situation changing so much. I think, you know, I sort of almost wonder if there is a great opportunity here for someone like Google to come along and say, you know what, we can solve all your problems. You don't need to run a complicated infrastructure. Yeah. We give you Google apps for education. We give you email. We give you, you know, access and identity management systems. You know, it's hosted off-site. We have backup in, you know, 100,000 server clusters that are around the world. You know, but then again, number one is funding IT. I just don't think, you know, IT organizations are going to be in the business of defunding themselves for free Google apps for education.
Well, it seems like also this list, there's a focus on consolidating the IT and information resources of the university in the CIO's office or in the administration, when really the thrust of the last well, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years of new information technology has been kind of smaller, quicker, lighter, more distributed. And you know, the web is like the best example of that, where services now are distributed. They're not like located in the mainframe in the secure data center of the university. You know, identity management is one of these things where, you know, we all struggle on our own with identity management. We all have different identities online. We have different email addresses. And you know, people manage that themselves. They don't really need – and I understand there's some different issues in the university where they need to keep track of who's who. But it just seems to me that this move towards consolidation is kind of just – completely at odds with the overall thrust of where IT is kind of headed. So
yeah, I think, you know, the big push right now, or the technology that's getting a lot of buzz in identity management, is OpenID. Right. And for those who haven't looked at OpenID before, it's a fully decentralized identity management system. So again, identity management being things like passwords and login and authentication, so that you can get access to services and you know, online collections and these sorts of things. And obviously that has to happen because the university pays a lot of money, for instance, to access to, you know, online scholarly resources, obviously your email, and, you know, obviously even more important for CIOs, I assume, would be the administrative backend functionality, the accounting systems, payroll, those sorts of things. So, you know, for those sorts of things, obviously access management has to, I suppose, happen on a local level. Although I assume that you know, there are companies out there like Salesforce that actually do also provide a web-enabled sort of payroll management and these sorts of things, HR management systems. And it does seem like it's trending toward, you know, web-based non-localized systems that really pose a huge threat to the core mission of IT departments on campuses.
But I agree with all of that, and I think that you know, I'm not going to deny that security is a big issue. I mean, one of our sister institutions here in Virginia just announced in the paper over the weekend that their faculty personnel database had been hacked repeatedly since October. So you know, I mean, this is an institution that's way more capitalized than we are, so presumably they can afford much better security. But so security is definitely an issue, and funding and capitalization of information technology is definitely an issue. I think that for me, what really this survey points to is the kind of disconnect between the management function and the educational and research function. I mean, the fact that there were no students asked to participate in creating this list, there were no faculty members asked to participate in creating this list, that's where the real problem comes in, because then you have, you know, what you have here is, you know, chief information officer saying this is what the university needs, and then the users of that technology, the faculty and the students and the staff members, are out there using it, and what was centrally planned doesn't actually work in the marketplace.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see, I think, what happens to these issues over the next year, because I think there is going to be a lot of pressure from students. I mean, I think it's very similar to sort of an analogous situation to what's going on, for instance, in healthcare, where, you know, the big buzzword in healthcare is patient-oriented care. So right. All the IT systems are oriented toward the quote-unquote consumer or the patient, where, you know, everything is reoriented toward that rather than the back-end systems and so forth. And there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, patients leaving with a printout of, you know, what the meeting was, you know, occurred, what the result was, when to come back, all of this stuff that's oriented toward better healthcare. That's a huge push right now in that realm. And I think ultimately that's what's got to happen, you know, in campuses as well and in mm-hmm. education. Well, on a lighter note, you know, one of the neat things that we've seen, speaking of distributed technologies that really caught our eye, and we wanted to discuss it last time, but we got crowded out by other issues, was this great new technology, distributed technology from Louis von Ahn, who is a MacArthur Genius Grant winner and has done really interesting web-based projects to take advantage of what he calls human computation. And so what he tries to do is have human beings who are distributed around the world solve problems that computers have a lot of problems with, like identifying what's in an image. It's a very complicated computer science problem. And he sets up little games or little things, widgets that enable a large team of people across the world to kind of solve these problems and report back the results of their solution to his server. And he's used this technology for different ends, including actually identity management and security. For instance, one of the technologies that he's worked a lot on is called CAPTCHA, C-A-P, how do you spell it? T-C-H-A, is that right?
Yep.
Which is the technology that's on a lot of blogs for when you want to enter a comment or when you want to register on a site. There'll be a kind of distorted, weird-looking set of numbers and letters, and you have to type that into the box. And so it requires human computation. It assumes that a computer couldn't figure that out and automate some kind of spamming or registration. I think this is a really terrific new project that he's got, which is ReCAPTCHA, and it's at recaptcha.net, ReCAPTCHA.net. And what he's doing is he's working with the Internet Archive and the people at the Open Content Alliance who are digitizing books that are in the public domain. So these are pre-1923 books. And a lot of them are being OCR'd or transferred from the page images into text. But there are cases where it's actually hard to do this. Obviously, again, hard for a computer to understand what the words are on the page. And they had this brilliant idea to chop up the words on the page into or the page into individual words, and then to use those as CAPTCHAs, these little tests for people who have to solve them to get through a password system or to add a blog comment. People solve the little puzzle, and then that information is sent back, and it essentially operates as a manual typing of the text. And I don't know, did you guys see this story when it came out?
No, I didn't see this one.
Oh yeah, this is really fantastic. I think I'm actually going to add it to my blog, and which currently doesn't have comments. And one of the reasons it doesn't have comments is that I found, and I'm sure anyone who runs a blog finds this, is that you get a lot of spam even with a bunch of the technologies that are out there. And so I think this is really a nice technology for people out there to add in to any site really that needs authentication. And it just has this fantastic secondary benefit of helping out the Open Content Alliance digitize and transcribe their works.
Yeah, this is very cool. I'm actually sorry, I was a little quiet there. I'm actually downloading it now, and I'm going to install it on my WordPress blog. They've got plugins for most of the major blogging platforms, so you can add it to your comments page and keep your comments clean of spam, and help them digitize these books in the process. It's very cool, and I just downloaded the plugin, and it looks super easy. I'm not quite finished with it yet, but it's super easy to install. So I mean, if our listeners have blogs, and I assume many of them do, this is something that just by installing you can help yourself and help the Internet Archive at the same time. So this is very
right.
Cool.
And for sites that that aren't based on templates like a WordPress, they actually have libraries in a couple of different languages, including PHP, which is a very popular web application language. And you can just use their existing libraries to go ahead and add it to your site. Well, usually every week we have a what we call our legal news. I think it's actually become a trend. And we decided this week to substitute instead of our legal news. We're going to call it This Week in Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was in a couple of stories this week. And two that really caught our eye and I think are sort of interesting to discuss. I mean, first of all, they sort of speak to the fact of how important Lincoln still is. But I think the one that got the most press was the discovery of a new handwritten note in the National Archives here in Washington, and that Lincoln had written to a general. And I believe historians had actually already seen the content of the letter because it had been transcribed and transmitted over a telegraph actually during the Civil War. So they knew the content of the letter, but this is the first time that the letter's been found. And at the same time, we noted that Al Gore was sort of caught using a quote from Lincoln that wasn't from Lincoln. And as our colleague Roy Rosenzweig likes to find out, the internet has been terrifically good at discovering frauds and fake quotations from different presidents. We actually have one in our book, Digital History. But it still speaks to, I thought it was interesting that despite the fact that we have this content, people still love to get the real thing, don't they, Mills?
You know, they really do, and I think that's why this newest, you know, the undiscovered Lincoln document, as some people were calling it, generated a lot of buzz. It's not that the document was undiscovered. It was just that we hadn't seen the original. And so the original is currently living at, you can see it at footnote.com. So it's, you know, it's gone into a commercial site, but, you know, an awful lot of primary source originals belong to collectors and others. And so this, at least, you know, footnote.com at least is making it available. But there's just something about seeing it that is more exciting than reading a typescript of what was in the note. And it's kind of unfortunate that Al Gore hadn't actually seen the original of the quotation that he included in his most recent book from Lincoln, which turns out to be a fake.
And so what was this quote that he used? It was something about the rich destroying democracy. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a critique of Gilded Age capitalism. And the there are, you know, a variety of theories about where this forgery or this fakery originated, but the most prominent one seems to be that it's from the 1880s, so it's an old fake, and that's one of the reasons that it's hung around seems to have a lot more authenticity, is that it's been around for, you know, more than 100 years and been quoted by an awful lot of people, but there's no evidence that it's actually a real quotation from Lincoln. And further, let's see, who was it? It was Andrew Ferguson, writing in the Washington Post this past week, points out that not only is there no evidence for it, but it's also just the prose is very un-Lincoln-esque. I mean, there are words in it that just Lincoln didn't use. So
I wonder if there's going to be more of this more buzz around the uncovering or rediscovery or whatever of these original documents as we get more and more tied to our computers. I wonder if there's, you know, maybe some nostalgia for the old way of doing research, as so many people now and our students definitely do this, do most of their research, sometimes all of their research, if they're writing a short paper or something something on something more contemporary. If they do all of their research online, I wonder if there's going to be this kind of nostalgia for opening up drawers and looking under beds and you know, pulling out shoeboxes of letters and original paper documents. I wonder if it's just a symptom of our current practices and the increase of online research.
Right. I think that will be the case. I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, in a digital age, I guess we get farther and farther away from the originals. And I think that also enables this kind of, fakery and a kind of, legends about what people say when, you know, we're not looking at the originals, we're not going back to the originals very often. I found actually Roy's essay that mentions this, and it's called "Digital Archives Are a Gift of Wisdom to Be Used Wisely." It was published in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and he mentions that the use of this online document, which was supposedly an 1829 letter to President Andrew Jackson from Martin Van Buren, who was then governor of New York, and supposedly this letter warned of the threat of the new technology, the railroad, which was going to destroy the old technology of canals. And actually, you can Google this. You can Google Van Buren railroads, and you'll find a lot of these quotes. And what I think Roy did is show what, you know, historians always have to do, which was, you know, to really think about would this have been something that Van Buren would have written or said. And he said it, you know, it sounded suspicious to him and to most American historians, because Van Buren actually opposed federal intervention in the economy. So, but this is a document that had been, you know, spread all over the web, and libertarians had really used it to, you know, basically show what, you know, idiots generally politicians are or liberals are, and, you know, for not letting the free market economy to work. And it's, you know, it's a total fake. I think it was actually discovered by Snopes.com, Snopes.com, which is one of these urban legend page. You know, it's these people, I think, going back to the original, I think it gives them some kind of security that, you know, there is something there, that there is some original that we can refer back to. And I think you know, it will become more important to keep looking back.
Snopes.com is actually a really good resource for tracking down a lot of these urban legends and their veracity.
Huh. Okay. Well, we'll have to take a look at more of that and maybe point our students there as well. Well, I mentioned at the beginning of our podcast our terrific staff here at the Center for History and New Media. And as we were thinking about featured story for this week, one of the things that we really had thought about in terms of our staff and indeed ourselves is that really, almost without exception, all of us don't have, I guess, what you'd call formal training in computer science or the kinds of technologies that we use here at the Center for History and New Media. And since it's the summertime, we're edging into the summer, we thought it'd be a good time to discuss, you know, since we often like to do things in the summer like learn a new language or start a new article or book project, you know, it's a good time to sort of pause and think about, you know, how people, our audience or of listeners can, you know, begin to pick up some of the skills that that people have here at the Center for History and New Media, and in general, in other digital humanities programs and you know, outside of the academy and libraries and museums, people who work on websites and online exhibits and at libraries and things like cataloging. And, you know, I think that, you know, this is a real problem for us, you know, now and in the future, because we found that it's becoming increasingly difficult to hire good people, to find particularly programmers. There seems to have been another little bounce in, I guess it's Web 2.0, and the number of people who are kind of going out into the commercial area who have technology skills. And so, you know, we've been sitting around wondering, you know, how are we going to actually find people to do the projects that we want to do? And I think in general, this is really a problem at libraries and museums and universities right now, is sort of finding people who have skills in the humanities, in our case, in history, but who also have technical skills. And we don't really see them coming out of, you know, a traditional, let's say, computer science bachelor's or master's degree. So we thought we'd go around and sort of talk about steps that people can take, you know, whether you're a manager or a student or a graduate student, and you want to kind of disseminate some of these technical skills or get people started on some of them. Some sort of, I guess, shortcuts that we found, ways of going about it. Maybe Mills, I'll discuss, I'll start with you, because you've actually taught in our Clio Wired series, which is the series we have at George Mason University for graduate students who want to learn about digital technology and how it relates to history and the humanities. What were the steps you took with your students to help them out on this front?
Well, you know, it's first of all, just as a lead in on this, I think some of our problems will get solved in the relative near term, only because at the moment we're the only place where doctoral students can actually do this kind of training work in information technology. But I, you know, a number of other programs are starting to think about it. University of Nebraska is probably the closest to bringing something online, and so that'll expand the pool a little bit. But
and we've thought about setting up one of these programs at George Mason as well.
That's right.
Right.
So when I teach my course for graduate students on digital humanities, in our case, as Dan says, is in history, the first question I ask them to think about is, why would you want to do whatever it is that you want to do in a digital environment, because there has to be a good reason to do it other than the fact that everybody's doing something digital. There are many projects that can be done just as well, if not better, in a print or other kind of analog form rather than digital. So there has to be a good reason why, and I really force them to think through why they want to go digital with whatever it is that they're working on. And then for the kind of project that they want to do, I make them go out and look at what's already out there and kind of critically analyze what seems to work well, what doesn't seem to work well, and why. And so then what lessons can they draw for their own project? And then the third question is, so therefore, what's appropriate? What kind of a digital technology is appropriate for what it is that you want to do, what it is that you want to accomplish? And then the training question arises, which is, now that you've answered all of those questions, what kinds of digital skills do you need to do that? And this is a very kind of pragmatic, unsystematic approach to acquiring these kinds of digital skills, because these are all doctoral students in a history program who have to finish their PhD, and their expectations on them as historians, and so they don't have the time to go, take two or three classes on Python or something like that. And so they have to figure out how to do the things that they want to do for the project that they want to complete and learn how to do those things well. And so, until such time as we have a different model of training for digital humanists, I think it's going to be this sort of haphazard approach that all of us went through as well, learning how to do the things we needed the computer to do for this particular project. So that's my general approach.
Right. And I think those are really great points. I think your point about looking at sites, I mean, look at what's out there and see what's already been done. There's so many good examples, and unfortunately there's a lot of bad examples as well of digital humanities projects. And so you want to, see what's out there and I guess take a look at, the technologies that are used and think about the ways in which, you can be pragmatic about it. Because I think a lot of people, when they start out, they do just want to, they say, oh, I need to learn about databases and I got to learn PHP from, beginners to advanced PHP. And it may turn out that you actually don't need those kinds of technologies for precisely what you want to do. Maybe you need some kind of social networking site that off the rack will work in the way you want to do it, and you don't need to do any programming. So I do think it's important to kind of see what's out there. I think those are terrific points. Tom, how do you approach this with your students and also with the staff at CH&M?
Yeah, I mean, I come at it much more from the perspective of a manager. I do a lot of the hiring and staff management and other things here at CH&M. And I think you're right, Dan, that we have not had very good luck with computer science graduates. It's not that we have hired a lot of them and they haven't worked out. It's that we haven't found computer scientists with the kind of skill set and kind of interests that we're looking for. Some of that is that we're not offering the kind of money that they can get in the private sector, but I also think some of it is a problem with the kinds of things they're learning in computer science courses. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But in terms of the kinds of people we do hire and the kinds of people we have had good experiences with, we've actually only hired one computer scientist, someone with a computer science background, and actually we converted her to history very quickly. Our former webmaster, Amanda Schumann,
right.
Ended up, came to us with a CS degree from Virginia Tech, and left after a couple of years, having completely converted to the other side, and is doing a PhD in Chinese history in Santa Cruz now. But the kinds of people that we have found who tend to be really good are actually people, young people coming out with BAs in the humanities who, and I think this ties in with what Mill says, who taught themselves, they tend to be self-taught, and they taught themselves a set of computer skills because they wanted to do something. They wanted to do something not for a class that they were taking. They wanted to do something for some other reason. I can point to one of our really talented young programmers now, a guy named Chris Kelly, who came out of Wesleyan. He took a trip to Tibet and China while he was in college, and he wanted to find a way to post some of the photographs he took on his trip, and he and his friends took on his trip, on the web, and create some kind of a photo gallery, photo sharing site. And he wasn't too pleased with the things he found out there online. And so he, you know, kind of taught himself a little bit of PHP and taught himself, I think he had already known a little bit of HTML, and built himself this photo sharing site. You know, it's that kind of person. And, you know, his interest is not in computers. His interest is in sharing photos. And it's that kind of person who takes the initiative, who sees that technology can help them do whatever it is they want to do. Those are the kinds of people I think we tend to look for, because I think those are the kinds of people we are. You know, we're not interested in technology for technology's sake. We're interested in technology because we believe that it can help us be better historians and better humanists. And so we tend to look for those same kinds of people for hiring. That's definitely a trend here, is that it's people who are interested in using technology, but not necessarily people who are interested in technology per se.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, we all have our inner geeks, but we like to suppress that geekiness because, you know, if you let it run amok, it's, you know, a lot of, I think, the projects that you can conceive of would be better done, in other media, and, you know, might be print. It might be a very simple technology like email. If you just want to communicate with a group, you don't necessarily have to set up a giant PHP bulletin board and with, you know, reCAPTCHA on it or anything like that. So, you know, you want to sort of think, I think, pragmatically about it. And, you know, what I tell people, I think, you know, Chris Kelly is a perfect example of, I think, how to go about it. And in fact, sort of went through the three-step process that Mills talked about, for sure. I think really, you know, looked at what was out there. I think it was still the early days of Flickr, and he didn't really like Flickr, and he sort of set something up. And I think in doing that, he learned about lots of different elements of the digital humanities, everything from, you know, scholarly web design and how to, you know, emphasize certain things in your web design that might be different than, you know, what's emphasized on Flickr. He also learned about, you know, principles like small multiples, which is, you know, using thumbnails in a grid so that someone can quickly scan through your photo collection. So he kind of picked up all these things on his own, and I think that makes it really a kind of stronger skill set, you know, because he's always thinking of the end goal rather than just in the technology, Tom, as you mentioned. You know, I guess what I'd add to the discussion is, you know, like probably the single most important thing is to begin using the medium. I mean, to use different tools so that you really understand how they work. You know, try out a social bookmarking tool like Delicious, or I use Magnolia. Try out a photo sharing site. Try these different technologies out and get a sense of, you know, what are they good at? And they're all good at certain things. But then also they're bad at certain other things. And they don't have certain elements that I think, you know, you can pick up as you begin to use them. And then I think a good next step, which is what Jeremy mentioned in our podcast, podcast number 6, where we talked to Jeremy Boggs, our creative lead at CHNM and web designer. You know, he mentioned, you know, if you're interested in web design, start off with, let's say, an installation of WordPress, which is blogging software. That's templated, and then just start playing around with the templates themselves. So, you know, rather than learning HTML from scratch, maybe you learn a little bit so you feel comfortable looking at what's under the hood in WordPress, and then go from there to you know, let's say modifying the CSS page or the page that works, that formats the other pages. So, you know, start off slowly and with an existing program and sort of play around with it. And you can get a feel that way rather than, let's say, deciding you're going to build a whole site from scratch. And, okay, so I need to learn Photoshop and I need to learn PHP and I need to learn HTML and CSS. And I think it can be kind of overwhelming when you look at it from that perspective. And I also agree that I think we're really at this point where there's a problem with existing computer science programs because they're really oriented toward a real kind of programming angle rather than a solution of programming problems rather than humanities problems, which you might tackle in a way that involves programming. And I've talked to computer scientists and they say, oh, well, computer scientists should be able to do any of this. But I still feel like that background in the humanities is really critical because you start thinking more deeply about really what technologies to apply to the problem.
Well, and as you were saying that, this relates a little to our earlier discussion about the IT managers and what their top 10 list was. But, I was thinking that when I was an undergraduate, these many years ago, one of the most popular science courses for humanists was what everybody called football physics, physics for everybody else. And I think it would be really nice to see computer science departments develop, computing for humanists or something like that. Some kind of a course to teach people like Chris Kelly or like we were when we first got started in this. How can you use these different technologies and what are some basic applications? In other words, open a whole series of doors for people and show them how to walk through those doors, whether it's databases or PHP or whatever it might be, and then they can start learning more on their own. That kind of introductory course for humanists, I think, would actually sell pretty well on a lot of campuses around the country.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think a lot of people who might want to go into the tech industry or work at a Yahoo or Google, but might not want a advanced degree in computer science could really use sort of an introduction. I'm amazed there aren't more, like physics for poets or football physics kinds of classes in computer science departments. I agree that they'd be very popular.
Yeah, I also think just there's this kind of, I think this is sort of part of a wider problem where, there are declining numbers of CS majors across the country. And, I think it is in large part because there's a lot of, it seems like this is a problem on the wider web as well. Like people coming out of CS departments are learning things like Pascal and C++ and these things that, are useful in some places, but they're not necessarily useful. Like it wasn't a CS major who came up with who founded Dig. It's not a CS major who built Flickr. It's people with these kind of more fluid skills, and it seems like those are the kinds of people we need, and those aren't the kinds of people being trained in computer science departments. And it may be worthwhile for some of us digital humanists to kind of reach out to our computer science colleagues and say to them, could you maybe is there a way we can work together to have web database classes, or can we work together to, it would be great if the GMU computer science department was pumping out, a whole bunch of people who knew, Ruby on Rails or those kinds of things that would maybe be more useful to our work, but also maybe more marketable in this Web 2.0 climate, kind of in the wider tech world. And so maybe some of the burden is on us to work with our colleagues in other departments to make sure that we have the kinds of people we need, because in the end, it's in their interest to be training people who have the skills that other industries want.
Right. I think what we're going to have to get over, I think, in computer science departments, though, which is going to be very difficult, is that feeling of it is computer science. And so I think a lot of the introductory courses in computer science, don't focus on, let's say, that kind of popular technology like Ruby on Rails or PHP, because they are teaching basic principles about algorithms and these sorts of basic things, and oftentimes they'll use more esoteric languages like Scheme to teach students, because they feel like any student who's studying computer science should be able to then go on and really easily do PHP or Rails. But we've actually found that's not necessarily the case, because there's a kind of practical hands-on knowledge to using something like Ruby on Rails that you only learn by actually doing it for a real site that has real issues and real growth. And so I think, it's a really difficult problem of kind of how to get that going.
it's also a kind of orientation, I think. It's not just that they, you know, I think someone who, you know, does, who starts with Scheme and, you know, becomes a really good Java programmer or something. I mean, obviously they're going to be able to pick up something like PHP, which is, you know, more rudimentary. But it's not just a matter of the technical ability and the technical knowledge and the technical capacity. It's a matter of kind of outlook and orientation and, you know, focus on the user and focus on the outward presentation versus, you know, focus on the code and focus on the like kind of internal consistency of your logic. I think there's a kind of, it's all my, you know, it's sort of like a two cultures kind of thing that we maybe need to bridge. And I noticed recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education blog, some computer science departments are adding what they're calling media computation programs, which do kind of change the orientation to digital art and web design rather than kind of traditional programming and computer science skills. So that seems to me to be a positive trend.
And I was at a conference in Chicago this past week at Columbia College Chicago, which is the other Columbia. They're the largest school for the fine and performing arts in the U.S., although largely unknown outside of the South Loop. And one of the people who was presenting was a computer scientist. She had 30 years in industry, had come back to teach there, and she was trying to teach programming to artists. And she said her first semester was a complete disaster, and because she was trying to teach it the way she'd learned it in a computer science PhD program many years ago. And so she, in desperation, switched to using game engines as a way of doing this. And she said it's just been a tremendous success because they're very easy to use. The systems developed for game programming are more modularized, and so she was able to then really get these art students excited and turned on about how to do the kinds of things they wanted to do in digital art by using game engine interfaces rather than traditional programming. So there are entrepreneurial ways to go about this, and I think we'll see a lot more of this in the coming years.
Well, I'd like to make one last comment is that we talked in the first segment about the priorities of CIOs at universities and IT administrators. And, you know, one of the things I noticed that wasn't on that list, that top 10 list, was, you know, hiring and employees. And, you know, if we were going to put together a list of you know, our priorities or our top 10 needs at CH&M for the next year, I would think that pretty close to number one would be, you know, what you might call recruitment and retention.
Absolutely.
And so I think it would be useful and helpful to see possibly some more support from the administration for helping us, you know, deal with these issues of recruitment and retention, and you know, have a higher focus on the employees rather than just the infrastructure and the servers and the funding and the administration of it all.
Well, I'd like to encourage our audience to actually help us out a little bit and maybe record, you know, how they got started in the digital realm and wherever you are, if you're a student or a professor or a librarian or someone working in a museum. You know, join in the discussion on our site at digitalcampus.tv under this episode number 8. Maybe people can say a bit more about how they got started and add some hints, I think, perhaps similar to some of the ones that we've thrown out today. So for our new listeners, those who are new to the program, we like to end the program with just a quick round the horn of sites or programs or services that we found online and off that might be helpful. Tom, what do you have for this week?
I've actually got a kind of an addendum to an earlier pick of the week that I made, a few weeks ago. I pointed to a list of 20 things you can do to make your blog better and to increase your audience and to make your users' experience smoother and more interesting. I've got
That's a great list, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I got another one of those kinds of sites. It probably doesn't have as much practical bearing in that it's not kind of a list of things you should do, but it is good for people who maintain blogs and websites to know a little bit about how Google works and how Google determines who gets to be number one on the list for a given search and how their PageRank system operates. Now, I should preface this by saying, it's all a little opaque, and PageRank is probably the most closely guarded industrial secret in the world right now. But we do know some things about it, and there's a great post on the Smashing Magazine website called Google PageRank: What Do We Know About It? And it's worth taking a look through there if you maintain a website to just kind of understand what Google is doing when they send their robots out and they do their indexes, what you can do, and you shouldn't try to game Google because there can be consequences to that. But the kinds of things that you should at least be thinking about so that Google can find you and that Google can give you the rank that they ought to be giving you. So we'll link to it in show notes. It's got a god awful URL, but it's called Google PageRank: What Do We Know About It?
Sounds great. We'll take a look at it. Mills, what do you have for this week?
Mine is actually an online museum, the Museum of Underwater Archaeology, which is hosted by one of our doctoral students here at George Mason, Kurt Norrell. And the reason I'm picking this one is because it's really in some ways the museum of the future. Kurt put this site up with cooperation at the University of Rhode Island with some partners he has there, and created the first couple of online exhibits, and then has opened up the architecture of the site to other maritime historians and underwater archaeologists, where they can create exhibits of their own and post them into the site. And so he's got contributions from people in eastern North Carolina, people in western Australia, just really stuff coming in from all over the world already. And so in many ways, this I think is going to be one of the museums of the – or a model for one of the museums of the future, because it has no physical presence anywhere in the world, but there's an incredible amount of very good information there, only a tiny fraction of which is actually created by the museum, meaning Kurt himself. So I think it's a really exciting way to think about the distributed museum and how this might work in the future.
And it seems to fit quite nicely into our future discussion about examples that you might want to take a look at before starting your own project.
Exactly.
Well, my site for the week is called Your Archives, and it's a project of the National Archives of the UK. Really an experiment, actually, that they're conducting, which is that they've put up a wiki that anyone can contribute to. And what they're hoping is that people who use their archive will go ahead and add notes, annotations, sort of finding aids as a distributed group of people to their collection. So, they have their official finding aids. And then if you're doing research, you can sort of add your notes in about what's in different folios and boxes and so forth, and add this to this growing wiki. And it's just kicked off, actually, I think about a month ago. So there's not a lot on the site. But it is interesting to kind of take a look at this, again, I think as an interesting experiment, I think, for particularly for libraries and museums who sort of, obviously don't have the time to go through all their material, but have a lot of people coming and doing research and taking notes. This is some way to aggregate on their site what people find. And I think it'll be interesting to see where this goes, if it's successful. You still find things on the site, like if you go to their page on London, the only thing that's there is it says it's in England. So there's still a lot of work to be done, I think, by the users, but it'll be interesting to watch this over the coming year and see if this is, like Mills, you said, if this might be a model for some kind of future museum or archive. And so we'll see where Your Archives goes over at the National Archives in the UK. Thanks for joining us, and we're looking forward to another discussion in 2 weeks here on Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Thank you.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.